Ecclesiastes chapter 5. I'm using the Black Pew Bible. This is found on page 673. I won't take time to point out the details this morning, but Ecclesiastes 5:10 to at least 6:9 is what we call a chiasm, meaning that there are things at the beginning and things at the end that parallel one another, and then there are things next and the things next to last that parallel one another, and the center of that is a message, and the center happens to be chapter 5, verses 18 to 20, wherein Solomon gives to us the good and fitting thing. So he's criticizing, he's highlighting, he's judging the way in which we have a wrong view of wealth and riches, but then he tells us how we are to have the right view there in verses 18 to 20. And then he moves again into his judgment against a wrong view of money. Does this mean then that this is the same sermon as we heard from chapter 5, verses 10 to 17? Yes. In one sense, yes. In another sense, no. Because Solomon does provide more things to consider, actually. And so we want to take some time to read the whole thing and see if we can hear some of the echoes in the latter portion, the portion we'll be preaching from and hearing from today. So with that, let us hear from Ecclesiastes 5, beginning at verse 10, all the way through 6:9. And our focus today will be verses 1 to 9 of chapter 6. Pay attention. This is the word of God. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting: to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity. and its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, and it never knows anything. It is better off than he. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place? All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and a striving after wind. So far from the word of God in Ecclesiastes. Well, Solomon in this portion has been dealing with the right and the wrong attitudes and actions concerning wealth. You saw there, or we just heard a moment ago in chapter 5, verse 10, it is vanity to love wealth. In verse 13, to love wealth produces a grievous evil, and to hoard wealth produces a grievous evil. And the word grievous evil, it's literally sick evil or evil sick. And the idea is that this is a miserable outcome. A miserable outcome. Miserable both in terms of the sickness it produces and the evil that's underlying it. In verse 16 of chapter 5, it also produces a grievous evil to lose wealth, whether by bad investment or by death. And so not being able to provide for your family. And then we saw in verses 18 to 20 that it is good, it is fitting to enjoy what God has given to you. Even this ability to enjoy the good produced from your labors, that's a gift from God as well. You notice that the text says that in verse 18, that not only has God given, sorry, it's in verse 19, not only has he given him riches and wealth, he has empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward. So it's a gift that God gives to them, and it's a gift that they can enjoy it. God, it says there in verse 9, in verse 20, keeps you occupied with the joys of your heart amidst a life that is filled with vanity. And then in chapter 6, verse 2, we saw that Solomon highlights another widespread evil, an evil that is prevalent among men, he says. It is a vanity and a severe affliction not to enjoy God's gift of prosperity. It is a miserable outcome. It's the same exact word, severe affliction in verse 2, and grievous evil. Same exact word in Hebrew. Pardon me. So, all of that being highlighted for you, let me just take a step back. First of all, I want to remind you what vanity means for Solomon. Vanity does not mean meaningless or pointless or futile. It's actually a bad translation, futility, futile. Vanity is the word hevel, and what it means is a word that's used for things like the smoke that comes when you blow out a candle. You can't grab the smoke and put it in your pocket. Hevel speaks of the shortness of life. And we've used three words to kind of express what vanity really means. It means fleeting, fading, and frustrating. And this life is fleeting, and it is fading, and it is frustrating, not only for the unbeliever, it is fleeting and fading and frustrating for the Christian as well. And the reason is because we were never meant to inhabit this world forever. We were meant to be with God. And so God has permitted and even allowed and even built in certain kinds of fleeting and fading and frustrating aspects to this life so that we wouldn't attach our hearts to this place as if it were our home. Now, that's a different take on the book of Ecclesiastes, but it seems to all of a sudden make much more sense of the text that we're reading. We're going to find the same today as well. So that's vanity. The Bible is also clear that all blessings come from God, and every provision is intended to reflect God's goodness to us, so that we are drawn to Him through the blessings and the provisions to God. We see the good things and all that God provides. And what that does is, it actually, as chapter 5, verse 20 says, it keeps us occupied with the gladness of our hearts. That is, it causes the vanity of this life to wear down some, and the joy that God has given to us to rise up some. Proverbs 10:22 says, "It is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and He adds no sorrow to it." Yeah, it's the opposite. He's seeking to bring joy to us through what He gives to us. And yet, our world is filled with people who resemble Solomon's example that we've just read about here in Ecclesiastes 6. Those who pursue a lasting satisfaction from the things in this world. It's a temptation for all of us. And yet when people find what they think they're looking for to make them happy, they find that they actually digress. They digress. They fall into a disappointment, and then into a greater dissatisfaction, and then to a discontentment, and then to a despair and depression. Solomon's going to highlight this for us today. Materialism is not something new to humanity. It's not a 20th century problem. What is maybe unique about our own context is that with industrialization, we've been able to produce so much stuff. There's so much for us to consume. And then you add to that the hyper-individualistic perspective, where we're always thinking about me, 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 me. Maybe in a unique way, our materialism is very self-destructive, because we have so many trinkets and tools and objects and toys and whatever else to try and put our hope in. Just very easy to flip from this to this to this. That's our challenge. But this is a word for us today, because the problem is not essentially materialism. The problem is not having things. God has given to us all kinds of things. The problem is seeking lasting satisfaction or fulfillment or hope or ultimate joy in those things. That's the problem. One reason that we then fall into this digression of disappointment to discontentment actually is highlighted from a line in Wallace Stevens' poem, Sunday Morning. He says, "But in contentment, I still feel the need for an imperishable bliss." That is, when I find myself happy for a moment, satisfied for a moment, it just seems to be not enough. It easily floats away. It's not imperishable. I'm looking for an imperishable bliss. Think about that. You've experienced that. Moments of contentment, which become fleeting and fading and frustrating in this life that's filled with vanity. And why is that? Well, all we have to do is go a little bit earlier to what Solomon said in chapter 2, that God has set, chapter 3, sorry, God has set eternity into our hearts. We're mindful of another kind of realm with another kind of satisfaction. And that's why contentment has the friendship with imperishable, a desire for or need for imperishable bliss. C.S. Lewis put it this way in his wartime BBC radio talk when he was speaking about the theme of hope. Listen to what he says. Most people, if they really learn how to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that can be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. I am not speaking of what would ordinarily be called unsuccessful marriage or unsuccessful trips and so on. I'm speaking of the best possible ones. There is always something we grasp at in that first moment of longing that just fades away in the reality. The spouse may be a good spouse. The scenery has been excellent. It has turned out to be a good job. But it has evaded us. Solomon here, when he speaks about the good and fitting thing, to eat and to drink and to enjoy oneself and all of one's labors, in the understanding that God has given these things as gifts to us, he's speaking about the kind of satisfaction and contentment that we can actually have in this life, and only as it relates to God. So we're going to go through this text, and we're going to consider the ways in which he highlights again the futility or the problem, the foolishness of putting our trust in money. But we're also going to spend a little bit of time talking then again about this theme of true satisfaction in this life that comes from seeing things through God and from God. I want to. I have 4 points. Then we're going to talk about wallowing in wealth is foolish, wavering in wealth is tragic, wandering for wealth is unsatisfying, and understanding your discontentment is profitable. Profitable. That's a little play on wealth words. Okay. So number one, wallowing in wealth is foolish. Wallowing in wealth is foolish. Let's look at verse 1. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, and yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. Now what's fascinating here is that the preacher, Kohelet, gives so much attention to labor, production, wealth, as he considers the things of this world, and not just in this chapter, but in previous chapters. And one thing that he finds fleeting, fading, and frustrating is what we might call the disappointment of success. Not the disappointment from not being successful, but the disappointment that comes from being successful. Success itself cannot bring lasting satisfaction to us. Now, our society acts like there is an association between wealth and contentment. You want to be happy? Just be very successful. But that's not the case. Actually, wealth for the sake of happiness, or I should say accruing wealth, gathering wealth for the sake of happiness, only creates what? An appetite for more wealth. It doesn't actually satiate you. It makes you hungry for more. because you're trying to get something out of it that it was never intended to give you. So money is incapable of satisfying this kind of soul hunger. And in fact, the more prosperous a society grows, like ours, what we find is that the more common depression shows up. It's exactly the opposite of what we would think. So what should we do? Well, to be satisfied. The old view, the view of the ancient days, would say, don't try to fulfill your desires. That doesn't work. That only provides more discontentment. Instead, try to curb your enthusiasm. Control and manage your desires so that you are never too emotionally attached to the things of this life. And therefore, you'll never become too disappointed. This is the worldview of the Stoics and the worldview of the Buddhists. And this doesn't work. it's foolish. Actually, it doesn't work to stuff down your emotions, to stuff down your desires, because God gave to us emotions and desires in His image. And He gave us those emotions and He gave us those desires in order to help us care about the things that He deems significant. What does God consider to be right and true and beautiful? He's given to us a way to not only appreciate those things, but to express those things through emotion and desire. Emotional detachment actually undermines the role that relationships are to play in our lives. And so we can't stuff down our and control our desires. Secondly, though, the reason why this is wrong is because to deny part of what makes me human is to dehumanize me. It hardens my heart. It makes me less human than I'm supposed to be. And that is never good. So, the ancient view is not something we want to adopt, but nor is the modern secular view. The modern secular view is no better. While warning against overdoing it, you know, don't get too emotionally attached. Modern culture encourages us to find satisfaction through active efforts to change our lives. Don't just accept life as it is. Make your life what you want it to be. That's the answer. And yet, seeking to change your circumstances, to pursue the job, the house, the family, the relationships, the prestige, the honor, the whatever, to seek to change your circumstances without asking a more fundamental question, which is, why am I so unsatisfied and discontent? Well, basically, that puts me in a place of pursuing my version of success, which ultimately leads to deeper discontentment. We've already highlighted this. So, Solomon here has the answer against both the ancient view and the modern secular view. Solomon points out here that God provides wealth and riches so that man lacks nothing. But can enjoy God through them. But what do we find here? God also can provide wealth so that man lacks nothing, and yet he can't eat it. Verse 2, he can't eat it. If you look at the parallel, a foreigner enjoys them. Literally, it says the foreigner eats from them. So he can't eat from the things that he's amassed, but this other one can come and eat from it. But the translators picked the word enjoy here. But that's the idea. You can't enjoy it. You're not able to see the good in it. And so God not only provides all things, but He provides even the ability to enjoy God's gifts as coming from God. So we've highlighted, just to see where we're at here, we've highlighted how we are to be satisfied. The ancient view doesn't work. The modern view doesn't work. Solomon gets into the text and he says, look, God gives us multiple things, and yet he also refrains from giving us the ability to enjoy it. And if we can press a little bit further, why does one man receive provision from God and he's able to enjoy it, and another man receives provision from God and he's not able to enjoy it? Well, chapter 5, verse 20 highlights the reason. The one who's enjoying the things that God gives, the one who can eat from them, is one who not often considers the years of his life, or literally the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with gladness in his heart. In other words, the one who rightly serves God with his wealth and who enjoys life under God and sees it all as a gift from God does not often remember the days of his life. He doesn't feel the vanity of this world in the same way. His life swiftly passes by because the vanity of this life is not considered as much as the joys of this life in God. Luther comments on this verse and he says, his heart is not vexed with cares and heaviness, neither of things past nor yet to come, because God cheers his heart. Thus he has a joy in his labor, and in the middle of evils, he enters into paradise. Well, in providing the reason why one can be satisfied amid their success, Solomon exposes why this one is discontent. Why it is that you and I find ourselves at times unable to enjoy what we have, unable to see the good in what God has provided. God is not my contentment. He's not your contentment in this life. And so your desires blind you from God's gifts. They blind you from God himself. We're going to come back to that theme in the end. I'm going to give you, we're going to go to the next point, but these will be much quicker. Number two, Solomon goes on and speaks about wavering in wealth and its tragedy. Wavering in wealth is tragic. If you look at verse 3, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, he does not even have a proper burial. And he goes on, but I'm going to stop there. Now, so Solomon provides the opposite circumstances from the one we saw in chapter 5. There was that guy who stockpiled his money and then he fell into financial ruin over a bad investment and he was unable to care for his son. Here, Solomon exaggerates the circumstances of blessing. He has 100 children. he has many years of life. He's just stacking up blessing upon blessing. In the ancient world, blessings were seen, they were counted often in terms of the children that you had and the wealth that you amassed and the years of life that you lived. And that's what Solomon is doing here. And he's saying, despite being substantially, overwhelmingly, hyperbolically blessed, his soul is not satisfied with good things. He is the exemplary picture of a blessed man who cannot enjoy his prosperity or delight in God. Here is, as one says, a man who experiences the good things of life but does not enjoy those good things. Instead, he is distracted. He is distracted. Instead of being distracted from the vanity of this life, that's what I meant to say. What he does is he's not only focused on the vanity of life. I want you to appreciate, because of his discontentment, he manufactures vanity. This one generates vanity. Kids, if I could say it this way, this one makes things. fleeting and fading and frustrating because he's so blessed. This is the kind of guy, you know, you look at someone's life and you think, man, that person has it all. And yet, they're just so miserable. They're so grumpy. They have such a bad attitude. And you think, how could that be? And then you even think this, you're tempted to think this, if I had what that guy had, I would not be like that. Well, it depends. Friends, if you don't see even the very things that you have now as a gift from God, you too manufacture vanity in your own life. You're going to carry, you know, whatever heart you have now with the things that God has given to you. If God gave you more, you'd carry that heart with you into all those blessings. So it kind of poses a question on you, doesn't it? How do you respond to the blessings that you have now? Solomon goes on to say something very shocking. He says, better the miscarriage than this man. Better the stillborn. Better the child who is born dead than this one who lives many years with a hundred kids, with a great wealth, and yet is not satisfied. Now, I need to say something about this. Solomon intends to shock you. Solomon is not minimizing the tragedy of miscarriage. Rather, the emphasis here is on the tragedy of a life abundantly blessed of God, and yet without satisfaction or joy, because they can't see God's goodness through his gifts. You know what Solomon's doing here? It's simply this. You hear about a child that dies at birth, and you think, oh, it's such a tragedy, and it really is. And you think, there is such a great potential for that life. They had such great potential, and it just seems to be wasted. It's all gone. And Solomon says, you want to know the life that's wasted? It's the life where you have so much blessing, and you just fritter it away because you're not happy with all that you have. He compares the life of the stillborn. He says it exhibits hevel if it comes in futility. Is this not true of both? Both of their lives are vanity? The stillborn leaves this world in obscurity. Is that not true of both? The stillborn's name is marked by this vagueness. Its name is covered in darkness. Is that not true of both? And yet the stillborn never sees the sun, and it never knows anything. And yet to Solomon, the stillborn is better off than the unsatisfied rich man. Literally, what he says there is, more rest has this one, has the stillborn, than the rich man. He's avoided the hevel. Verse 6, even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, he's wasted it. His situation is much worse than the stillborn's. Do not all go to one place. In other words, a life lived without contentment or enjoyment of the good things could last 2,000 years and yet remain unrewarding. Well, you get the point. Let's move to the third. And so this one becomes wavering, even in the midst of such blessing. Let's move to the third point, wandering for wealth. Wandering for wealth is unsatisfying. It says in verse 7, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. What Solomon wants to highlight in these verses 7 to 9 is man's insatiable desires, his ability to never have his desires satisfied, his appetites met. First, he points out that all men work because they're driven by their needs. Represented by a mouth here, right? The mouth needs to be filled. So a man's labor is for his mouth. That is a similar Proverbs 16:26. A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. You know, why do you work? Because you need to eat. That's true for everybody. What he goes on to say is that earthly labor cannot by itself fill the emptiness of the soul. In other words, we cannot expect the wealth of this world to bring us satisfaction. We cannot expect the riches of this world to nourish or enrich the soul. Matthew Henry says, "The desires of the soul find nothing in the wealth of the world to give them any satisfaction." It doesn't stop man from trying, does it? Solomon then raises the question of possible advantage here. He says in verse 8, "What advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living?" Now, usually when he asks this question, what advantage is there? The rhetorical answer is almost always none. There's no advantage. But here, there is an advantage. The advantage is supplied in verse 9. What the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. In other words, what he's saying is this: the advantage that the wise has over the fool is that the wise one is able to appreciate what's in front of them. What the poor has as an advantage over the rich is that the poor appreciate often what they have in front of them. There's a clear contrast then between the seeing eye and the desiring soul. One possesses, the other pines after what they don't have. We could simply say it this way. We could summarize verse 9 in this way. We should rest content with what lies before us and resist the temptation to wander off in search of more. But there's a greater contrast. It's not so obvious in the English. In verse 8, I want you to notice that the satisfied poor knows how to walk well through life's challenges with what he's been given. The word there for walk is halak. In verse 9, it says, the unsatisfied soul, let me find it here. what the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. That word desires there is actually the word halak. It's the word for walking around. The contrast here is this, and it's like I said, it's missing English. The satisfied poor knows how to walk well in this life. The unsatisfied soul walks or wanders through life, searching for what he craves, searching for what he can gain. You see, and that's why I said this for this third point, wandering for wealth is unsatisfying. There's always this trying to amass things, but you know, the rich will not spare any expense. They'll go to the lengths of the earth to find the thing that will make them happy, and they won't find it. Will you walk in this life enjoying God who blesses? Or will you wander the ends of the earth pursuing blessing on your own terms? The wanderer's appetite is not satisfied, and therefore they're left without advantage. What lies before them is never good enough. Well, here then are the miseries of disordering wealth. We find ourselves wavering, wandering. I want to come back then to that final theme in my closing. And this is our fourth point in our conclusion. Understanding your discontentment is profitable. Why don't we turn to the question, why am I discontent? And what I have to present to you is really something we've been talking about in our apologetic study on Monday. We might find the ancient view to not be helpful. We might find the modern secular view to not be helpful. because they're not really asking why I'm discontent. They're just trying to figure out ways to try and make ourselves content, whether it's squelching our emotions or whether it's changing our circumstances. But one time-tested explanation that really seeks to answer the question, why am I discontent, comes from the Christian philosopher Augustine, or Augustine of Hippo, depending on how you want to pronounce his name. And he wrote on discontentment. And he says the reason why we're discontent is because our loves are out of order. Our loves are out of order. Some think that we are the sum of all that we believe. Others think that at our core, we are what we do, how we act. But Augustine said that we are most fundamentally shaped not as much by what we believe or think or even do, but by what we love. Augustine said this, "For when we ask whether somebody is a good person, we're not asking what he believes or hopes for, but what he loves." And in this way, Augustine is highlighting that our human virtues, our gifts and graces, are really just forms of love. You want to grow in courage? Courage is loving your neighbor's well-being more than your own safety. Honesty is loving your neighbor's interests more than your own interests, even when the truth will disadvantage you. Jesus himself said that all of God's law can be summarized by loving God and loving our neighbor. And so Augustine believed each and every sin could also be defined chiefly as a lack of love. So virtue is a way that we love, and sin is a lack of love. And so what you love most at any moment is what constrains and controls your thoughts and your actions at that moment. He said, a body by its weight tends to move toward its proper place. My weight is my love. Wherever I am carried, my love is carrying me. So in other words, Augustine is teaching us, you are what you love. Now, why is that important here? Well, because what he says is that, you see, the heart's loves have an order, a priority to them. And the reason why we're discontent is because they're out of order. Let me explain. Augustine says, a just and a good person is a person who has rightly ordered his love so that he does not love what is wrong to love, or fail to love what should be loved, or love too much what should be loved less, or too little what should be loved more. And so due to sin, we often love right things in the wrong order. We take the less important things and we make them greater. We take the most important things and we put them down lower on our orders of love. And so unhappiness and discontentment, these are disorders of our lives because we've disordered our loves. If you love your work, which you should, that's okay. But if you love your work more than your family, you have a disordered love, and it will ruin your family. If you love making money, I didn't say you love money. If you love making money, but you love making money more than you love doing what's right, then you will abuse your employees to the ruin of those who you have responsibility over. And we could go on and on through this. And so the point is that your discontentment comes from a disordered love. And Augustine is getting this teaching right out of the Scriptures. And in part, he's getting it right from Ecclesiastes. Satisfaction and contentment are not found in possessions and wealth and riches. Satisfaction and contentment are found in God. That's what Solomon says. And the ultimate disordered love, Augustine would say, the ultimate source of discontentment is a failure to love first things first. It is a failure to love God supremely. You remember what Christ said when he confronted the church in Ephesus. You've forgotten your first love. We were made to be in communion with the triune God. We were made to share in the love and the communion and the joy of the interpersonal Trinity, and to share in ever-growing degrees of joy and glory as we would love and serve and worship God who loves and helps and promotes us. We were meant to do this with God above all things in the creation. And whether we acknowledge God or not, since we were created for it, you and I will always be looking for the infinite joy that we were designed to find in loving communion with the divine. The problem is that we often look for that joy in things instead of God. The reason even the best possible worldly goods will not satisfy is because we were created for a degree of delight and fulfillment that these things cannot produce. Augustine said, "You stir man," he's in prayer, he says to God, "God, you stir man to take pleasure in praising you because you've made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it finds rest in you." That's what Solomon's talking about, is a restless, discontented people who feel the vanity of life moment by moment and are trying so hard to escape it, but they're looking for their escape in all of the wrong, they're looking for their rescue in all the wrong things. We were made for God, and so nothing can give us the infinite joy that God can. Augustine said again in his prayer, "All things are precious because all are beautiful. But what is more beautiful than you, O God? Strong they are, but what is stronger than God? If you seek for anything better, you will do wrong to Him and harm to yourself by preferring to Him that which He made when He would willingly give Himself to you." You see, when you love anything more than God, you harm the object of your disordered love. You harm yourself. You harm the community around you. And you end up like this man in Ecclesiastes 6:3, whose soul is not satisfied with good things. Deeply dissatisfied. Wandering for gain. Or as Augustine would say, wandering for love. Well, we began with a quote from C.S. Lewis and his radio program. I want to close with another quote from Lewis's radio program. And it's much shorter, but it expresses well this biblical perspective, this Augustinian perspective. And here's what he says. "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist." Just think about that for a minute. You don't desire something. You don't desire something unless the satisfaction that is to come from that desire actually exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. People feel sexual desires. Well, there's such a thing as intimacy and love. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this life or in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is not that it doesn't exist. The most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Right? That's what Solomon is saying. He's put eternity into our hearts. Stop trusting and hoping in material things, in relationships, in the creation, and look to the Creator and be occupied with Him for the gladness of your heart. Amen. Let's pray.